cult is real, although I dare say that most people that we talk lightly to about the cult perhaps just dabble in it, about on the same level that the average person that we talk lightly to about Christianity dabbles in Christianity quite nicely. But it is very real. It's invocatory of powers that have their realities, the kind of realities that we have to deal with every day, those of us have to do. The devil's already working, obviously. That's a sign of the guys. Do that, a sign of kinesis. These powers are real that we're going to talk about tonight. I want to make that very clear. If that reality is thought of in some materialistic sense is only subjective, that is, it's intracranial within the mind of man, you may think in those terms. If you want to think of them in some more exteriorized way as a power let loose within the human community in sociological terms, you may think in those terms. Those forms of thought will do. And if you want to make the kind of step that is made within scripture, for example, which of course was written thousands of years ago, and within the religious tradition per se, which has a long history of thinking of these forces as having perhaps an exteriorization that's more than sociological belief or habit or circumstance, and you may do that too. But the point I'd like to say, first of all, as a social scientist, as well as a pastor, is that these are real things that we're talking about. Although many times we play at them as if they were games, and sometimes they are games and they're good fun. It's rather strange, I suppose, that we should come 70 miles or so from civilization, and some of us traveled 2,500 miles or so to get here, to a church camp, to a Lutheran camp, and then we would get one of the largest gatherings of the week for a discussion of the occult. Think about it. If it had been on the atonement, I'd have been down here with three people, all over 50. Think about it, really, it's serious. But it's only a reflection of the fact that, you know, when we came in here, while some of us quit shaving and washing and other kinds of things, we didn't cast off, you know, the reality of our society. Each one of us, whether we came from Saskatchewan or South Carolina, came in as someone not inserted into the world, but a part of the world, part of our culture. And I dare say that the two major religions of North America today is the rather superficial piety that we call by way of the Jesus people or something on the one hand, and the less superficial, but certainly much more dangerous and to be contended with, religion of occultism in all its forms. I don't say that lightly, because occultism is a very real religious force. It always has been, but it has been a counterpuncture, or rather underground element for hundreds of years in the West, and has surfaced, not just recently, it has surfaced in the late 19th century, and increasingly in the earlier part of the 20th century, and now since World War II, and out on our continent, as a major contending force for the allegiances of man. Well, what do we mean by the occult? To be occult means essentially to be arcane, that is, to be hidden. A name given to a very wide variety of practices over many thousands of years, due to the fact that the predominant religions of many societies militated against these kinds of practices in the name of the state religion. Not just Catholic and Protestant Christianity within our own realm of history that we're familiar with. We know that not even the United States, supposedly relatively young nation, has escaped having a history of persecution of occultic practices in the name of the state's religion. We know about Salem and Massachusetts. We know that many of the early colonies, many of the early states contained statutes, for example, in their legislative codes against wizardry and witches. Legislation, I might add, although I'm not a lawyer, I think this is relatively true, is not completely expunged from the books, since we still have codes against palmistry and fortune telling and things of that nature in many places. This exists as a holdover from European law, which was never as strong in England as it was in Germany and Austria and some other countries on the continent, where the death penalty was given right on up into the late 1700s for practice of witchcraft, dealing with the arcane, that is, hidden spiritual forces that were identified rightly or wrongly, but nevertheless identified with the antithesis of the Christian religion, that is, with the kingdom of hell, with Satan. Okay, the occult. A hidden wisdom, on the one hand hidden because it was persecuted before Christianity, and along with the rise of Christianity, persecuted by Judaism, persecuted by Islam, persecuted by Zoroastrianism, persecuted by a large number of faiths in all parts of the world, because kind of things that we would call occultism, that is divination, attempting to ascertain what are the real forces and possibilities at work in the world now, prediction, that is, what really is going to come about, and other things of this nature have been the prerogative of the state religions, generally speaking, whether they are Confucian in China or Christian in Germany. And yet occult in another sense too. And there must be some more chairs here someplace. Aren't there some chairs down the hall for some of the people? Well, goodness. We have to share something. Okay. Occult too, because the wisdom, supposedly, which by the way is the root for the word that gives us which, Vita or Wita, means wise or wisdom. This wisdom is not something freely dispensed, never has been freely dispensed, but it's something costly in terms of human sacrifice and of time and toil and danger, pain, treasure, to attain. So hidden in that sense, so that it would be theologically or religiously somewhat similar to what we call Gnosticism in religion. That is, that there is a fund of secret wisdom that has been revealed from the supernal world, but only to the elect, as it were, only to the wise, the magi, to the wise man, the witan, the one who has wisdom. And this wisdom then is his stock and trade. Up until about 4 years ago, I suppose, the only interest I had in the occult was the occasional looking at horoscopes or something of this nature in the newspaper, or being interested that there were people silly enough to read things like triple leaf fortune telling and this sort of business. Had really no interest at all. I tended to be a kind of a rationalistic skeptic. This is not by way of self-glorification to tell you how I got into the subject, didn't take it very seriously at all. In fact, it caused me to commit one of the worst errors that a scholar can commit, and that was when the Lutheran Church gave me a grant that enabled me to get free and do a little research on the youth culture and write the book, The New Mentality, which suggested that there was a totally new form of consciousness developing in North America, at least among the younger generation. It was not just a question of communication across generations, but there was a whole new set of values and ways of looking at things, and for my part it was a heck of a lot better than the older way. And doing this book and in talking to young people and studying the artifacts of the culture, I just completely screamed out, and this is totally possible, it's a psychological fact. I just screamed out the fact that occultic objects and occultic language was a part of the youth culture. I'm not the only one, by the way, that missed it. Most everyone else who followed after me in that field, Charles Wright and the others, also missed this element. And I think it probably was due to the fact Wright was trained as a lawyer, and I had been trained in several rationalistic sciences, and we just simply couldn't take it seriously. Anthropologically, we could see American Indian strains, you know. Religiously, we could see Buddhism and Zen. That made sense to us. You know, even historically, we could see, you know, dressing up like the Magi or something like this, but we just couldn't take witchcraft seriously. Our minds screened it up. That happened. And so I was convinced, after thinking about it for a while, looking at the book got a better reception, I suppose, than it deserved, because that there was something to it. I was in Philadelphia doing something that people shouldn't do. I was talking to a competitor for one of the companies for whom I've worked for many years, and he asked me what I thought about the rise of interest in the occult. I said, well, I really haven't thought much about it. We spent a long time talking about it, and then I did something else I couldn't do. I went over to my publisher and asked him if he thought about it. He said, no, but it sounded like a good idea, and why didn't we check it out? So we walked around the various bookstores in the city of Philadelphia, which is, you know, no great shining center of culture, but it has a lot of bookstores. We found out something on just curious examination like that that was later borne out by a six-month study that was funded by the Society of Religious Publications. And that was the books on religion, even the kind of, frankly, trashy religious books that have always sold like mad, the self-help, inspirational, daily prayer types of things, had been shoved back into the stack. Well, you had to really dig them out if you wanted them. All the books on display and the books that the managers reported as turning over, the kinds that have the little keys on them that they take off at the cash register, have you ever noticed that? That's how we control when we want to know how the people are buying books. The books that were selling and had been selling for a long time past were on palmistry, numerology, astrology, horoscopes, witchcraft, divination, primitive religion, the whole smear. And so we later had this research done. We freed an editor for 6 months to do the research, and sure enough we found out that while, and you probably all know this, religious publication is in trouble, it's almost impossible to sell a book on religion in these states in North America. You could do so if it had anything to do with the occult, because anything. There was a book on aircraft design that promised it was going to be about horoscopes or something would sell, and it's really true. And so, well, why is this the case? And that's what I set out to try to find out in Religion in the Age of Aquarius. So, not exactly what you would say a confirmed believer in occultism or anything, but I take it very seriously indeed. I just want to read a few excerpts from the results of some year and a half study now to you for the interest of time. You read some of this, you have to give me. The scene is in the emergency room of a large hospital in the western United States. A screaming, cursing young woman is brought in, wrist bleeding from an attempt with a knife upon a drug dealer's life. Battling both police and interns, the bleeding girl seems beyond medical help, although several physicians stand back against the far wall. Suddenly, the girl's eyes fasten on the face of a frightened young physician, fixing his attention by the intensity of his stare. You can help me, man. You with the understanding face. She says this in her first clear statement. Timidly, the doctor approaches her and is allowed to bind her wrist. She whispers to him as he works, I knew I could trust you. You're an Aquarius, aren't you? Baffled, the doctor says, I don't know if I am or not. Check on it. You're Aquarius. I know you are. Later, troubled by the incident, the young doctor checks his birth date and his sun sign, and he is an Aquarius. Now, this is not fiction, but fact. This event happened to a very personal friend of mine, a physician I've known, his friend and his medical advisor for a long time. And in checking beyond this, I found that many professors, many people counseling young people, psychologists, psychiatrists, religious thinkers, agree with my doctor friend and I that we are living in the age of Aquarius, if we understand that as an age of intense religiosity that bears, however, a mark and a drift of the occultic rather than the Christian or Judaic or really any other traditional religious sign. Now that's by way simply of incident. You know, one of the ways this is off the subject that we used to deal with things like that was coincidence. Let me tell you, after a while, coincidence after coincidence after coincidence builds up, and it begins to strain even someone who's spent a fruitless 4 or 5 years teaching logic, as I did one time. You get so skeptical after a while. The coincidence, for example, part of the research was getting as many readings on myself as I could, because, you know, I don't know anybody as well as I know myself. So I'd get my horoscope cast and my palm read and all of this, and you tell me what's going to happen to me and so forth, and I could check it. So I paid to have one of these big computerized horoscopes made. Yeah. I wasted money, but I took it off the income tax. And you can get all these kinds of things done, as you know. Well, this one is a really big thing, very impressive. And to someone, you know, who hadn't had to wade through stuff from the computer every day the way I did in university, it would have impressed the hell out of it. And so I began reading through it. Very, very well done. Okay. One thing I said, I'm going to check this thing out. It's for 1 year. I'm going to check it out every day. And while I won't bother to keep the mathematics on it, I will keep it above a little tally and see what kind of coincidences or what kind of things happen, okay? First thing you have to be aware of is fulfilled prophecy. You know that. If I prophesy you're going to fall down and sprain your ankle on the way back to the lodge tonight, and it happens, of course, you know, I am partially responsible there, probably, if you suggest, will you? So I decided I wouldn't read the thing ahead. I read the preamble, which was rather lengthy about the kind of year it was going to be, and so forth. I wouldn't read the day until I was ready to go to bed at night. It was the 1st of January. I would read it as I went to bed, and that is January 1st. So I did this. Check, check, check. Well, to make a long story short, along about the last of February, I think in terms of academic years, so you know, February is in the middle of the year for me, you must begin. I was coming home from my office, driving very carefully because there was snow and ice, and suddenly I hit some glaze ice. Although I was going slow, I started picking up speed going downhill, head on right in the middle of a great big truck. It totaled out the car and almost totaled out me. Well, after I got back home after a couple of hours, I lay down in bed and I picked up my horoscope. It said, beware of driving today, extreme risk of accident. No, that's scout sign. And that happened a lot of times during the year. And I know as well as you do, if you know anything about computers, that they had that thing all cranked up with about 10 million answers, you know, and it spun around at random and cranked those things out for the day, probably. Makes you believe in synchronicity, if you know anything about synchronicity, in psychotherapeutic theory. Things just don't happen by chance, you know. So, over and over again, coincidence, coincidence, coincidence. Here's one section that I later just picked out and wrote up as an article. It could be that some of you saw it because it was in the religious education magazines of all the Lutheran synods. But just to try to set a kind of a scene of an occultic household, of which there are many, mostly the ones that I know are around university, college type communities, but not completely. I just call it the setting and decor of the occult, and there is no single word of this that isn't fact. It isn't fact. I mean, nothing is made up in this book that I didn't, you know, research. Imagine yourself walking down a major street of a medium-sized city with fewer than 100,000 residents. A small, very well-known liberal arts college lies on your left. To the right opens a sedate residential street. You turn right and walk under the graceful old trees that line the sidewalk. On the right is a brick bungalow, the home of a nationally known psychiatrist. Just down the way, the chairman of the department of a major university makes his home. Hardly the place to go witch hunting. Hardly. And yet across the street, one house down, is the location of a coven. 5 people, 3 men, 2 women, and all of them witches. We cross the street and climb the stairs of an old mansion whose air is one of tiredness. It is not a run-down building. The house is painted in sweat, but its glory is gone. Now it's divided into apartments, 2 up and 2 down. We go upstairs and knock at a door. It opens at our rap of its own weight. The door is not locked, nor has it a lock at all. The rooms of the coven stand open to the world. What rooms these are? There are 5 rooms, all differently decorated. In a room we enter, dolls, painted and distorted and torn, are hanging everywhere. A crushed skull stands on a shelf. Coffee table supports a bird cage in the middle of the room. Inside the cage is a painted doll rather than a bird. From time to time, someone takes a sword and torments the doll, all the while calling it Cosmic Charlie, which means by you know who. One corner contains the fireplace. A gas log fire is burning there. Several other persons are seated in front of this fire. They're grooving or flashing on the flickering gas light, for the people in this room are almost completely stoned, intoxicated on drugs. Someone greets us and hands us the skull. It's a grotesque item, old, brown, with a jaw missing and a crushed in line running from the right eye to the top of the skull. The boy who has given us the skull tells us it is the remains of a murder victim, dug up in an adjoining city by black cultic friends who sent it on to them as presents. We are offered a pack of cigarettes, decline it, wander off to another room. Wandering through the crowd of guests in the dim light, we're struck by the wild expressions on the faces of some of the people present. A tall, beautiful, black-haired girl sways back and forth as if hypnotized. Incidentally, some of these guests are rather far out on LSD. The next room is brightly painted. At first, it reminds us of a little girl's room. There's one significant difference. All of the furniture in this room has been very carefully bolted to the ceiling. Brightly glowing, hip colors cover the table, 4 chairs, dishes, silverware, glasses, and flowers that hang suspended from the ceiling. This witty, amusingly decorated room lightens our outlook, and some of the sense of evil that we felt in the other room falls away from us. The next room returns some of that foreboding. Because of its color, as well as on because of the direction in which it drives our thoughts. It is a small room, painted completely black, a deep ebony shining black from floor to ceiling. Only one object is in the room, a brass bed. All of it is painted black too, except for the large rails at the head and foot, which glow richly in the light falling from the next room. There are no lights and no other objects in this bedroom. We walk back towards the front room and become aware of exotic music coming from a record player hidden somewhere in a dark corner. A few of the people in the larger room are moving back and forth to the music, dancing, grooving to the weird sound. From their behavior, we would judge that at least some of these people are homosexual. I go on to analyze the characteristics of the people at that meeting, which is less descriptive. All writers love to describe things, you know, so you have to give them. That's the whole essence. It's like painting. Then you have to analyze them. Among the things mentioned by the people at this party was their connection with other black occultic groups in neighboring cities as a network. Now, this took place in the upper south, middle west, and not long after this, some 6 to 8 months after this, in Louisville, Kentucky, a rather sophisticated and large city, the Church of Satan was opened there. And although it wasn't demanded or asked of them, and I'm not talking about the Church of Satan in this particular thing, by the way, that's another phenomenon, but the Church of Satan was opened there, and the 48 or 50 members, grown people who joined this, insisted on writing and signing the charter in their own blood. In other words, just like when we used to play pirates, they ended up cutting their hands and putting up enough blood to do it, the ex-lion tamer down in L.A. was really glad to get, I'm sure, puts it under glass. Anton LaVey, who's a big joke, but these people weren't joking when they did that. The characteristics of the cult members seem to be the following. All of them were young, under 30 for the most part, with high school and some college education. Almost all are now out of college or high school and working at white-collar jobs. All seem to be single, but many are living together, often with several men and women sharing the same apartment. The use of wine, beer, marijuana, and drugs, as well as psychedelics, seems to be universal among them. While totally alienated from the society in which they're located, they seem to be apolitical. Each person seems turned in upon himself or herself, fascinated by the internal contradictions he finds within himself. Their philosophy of life is best described as a sensationalist hedonism. And I suppose that's best put by a button I saw in Greenwich Village one time. It says, if it feels good, do it. For them, evil is more fun than good. For this group. And a great pleasure is derived from shocking and frightening the more passive types of hippie students who live in the other apartments in the area. This is really how they get their kicks in life, because they can really drive some of the students up the wall. I'll tell you some stories about medical help we had to take for some time. One very upset hippie type who visited the coven often says he believes they would like to make a human sacrifice just to see what that trip would be like. And of course, that is not the only place like that in North America. Because the book is 200 pages long, I can't read it all and shouldn't. I'll just read the epilogue now and then, which goes to this section. After considering the things discussed in this book, I've drawn one major conclusion. That is, there is a connection between the abuse of drugs and the rise of interest in the occult. This conclusion rests upon investigation of the activities of young people, to be sure, and does not reflect necessarily upon the interest in astrology and palm reading and other silliness on the part of a lot of middle-aged people. That is a long tradition, and being an idiot isn't something we invented in the 1970s. It's been around a long time. Because of the fact that interest in the occult among young people and interest in the use of drugs both, and I'm not saying that belief in the occult makes you use drugs, and I'm not saying that using drugs makes you believe in the occult. Life is never simple. I'm saying something else. Interest in the occult and interest in the escapism of drugs both grow out of a sense of alienation from self and from community. That they are found together so often is a question of proximity, that they are already there, where people fall, and I don't know any better verb to use, fall, as it were, out of community and out of some interior integrity into alienation, first from self and then society. I would also conclude that the most alienated occult groups are the fastest growing. In other words, the ones that are the furthest out, to use the jargon, are the ones that are growing the fastest, just as Dean Kelly has found that the religions in America that really make the most demands upon your sacrificing your mind and accepting rigid doctrines, which oftentimes not only don't make sense, but they don't do any good either. These are the religions which are growing the fastest. Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, Bible fundamentalistic churches that demand, you know, everything but cutting off your left hand. These kinds of things are what people are searching for. Just as they follow the little man with a mustache, you know, and a big ego a few years ago when they were alienated from self and community in a land in which we have a lot of relatives. But it is the alienation that is the brains for all of this. I've seen a good deal that backs up this insight. No one who knows college-age young people can be unaware of the deeply disturbed minds of so many of them. No one has such people's trust, can be unaware of how great is the number of people in their teens and twenties who are estranged to one degree or another from the aims of governmental policy and the goals of institutional religion, and I would say quite fairly and legitimately estranged. In many, alienation from parents, teachers, clergy, and college administrators is complete, and the relative peacefulness, which is only relative, not total, on college campuses in the last year and a half, is a mark of the deepening alienation, not of its evaporation. There comes a point when you care so little about things that you will no longer fight. And as a soldier, I can tell you that's when you start losing wars. So that the peace that we have had relatively of late, in my mind, is the most black thing, not the hopeful sign that the shallower thinkers have made out of it. It is almost complete. I'm speaking now about graduate students mostly because I've had more contact with them in the last 4 or 5 years, but this is true also of your seniors graduating. I've been glad to have been moonlighting this last year, teaching sophomore and freshman again, something I haven't been able to do in over a decade. And I find that it's true there too, in its degree. This is by no means a condition that clears up on graduation from college. The military is now full of young men with this attitude, as is the ranks of business. These estranged people find their only release, oftentimes, in pot parties, acid trips on weekends, and increasingly in many places, in more or less satanic meetings in which sexual experimentation passes over into sadism and masochism, that is, into cruelty, and drug intoxication passes into psychotic episodes. Witchcraft is real. And of course, you'd have to go through the chapters in this to see on what I can base this. This is another conclusion that must be drawn. Witchcraft is the practice of the power of suggestion by a person or persons of an aggressive frame of mind upon other persons of a hysterical, that means highly suggestive, disposition. We seem to have a very great number of highly suggestive young and older people today. They are prey to the suggestibility of more aggressive people who turn them onto drugs, to casual sex, to troglodyte politics, and lately to very weird occultic religious practices. And there is reason for this too, and the person that you ought to consult on this is Martha McLuhan. Because we have all, you know, been softened up beyond that which is normal for a human society for suggestibility by way of our exposure to television and radio for such large amounts of time every day. And it frightens me to think now that television has been around so long that, you know, there are people old enough to vote who have been babysat by the television from the very beginning and who believe the gospel did not come by John or by Jesus, but by Walter Cronkite or by Mickey Mouse Club or something like that. Without the criteria to screen out the true and the false, and we get all this ridiculous charges made against the commentators on the news and so forth, which is just a way of trying to pass the buck from making your own mind up about, you know, what is real and what is not. Suggestibility, an electronic, total electronic society, that's what we really live in, is a society in which we are tribalized because we are subject to suggestibility, just as the so-called tribal societies of Central Africa, subject to mass epidemic of hysteria by suggestibility from the priest, the doctor, who would say, you know, plague is coming, you've offended the totem of the taboo or something of this nature. We live exactly like this. And no one is in a logging camp unless it's Holden Village so far away that he isn't immediately hit by this kind of hysteria. But that's another story. I have seen the tremendous psychic damage being done to many young people by the irresponsible use of debilitating drugs. The little worlds of black magic groups everywhere are surrounded by larger worlds of other young people affected by the hard inner core. These fringe people show signs of fearfulness, approaching paranoia, and definite character disorganization. In other words, they're going bananas. They're falling apart. From the misuse of the drugs they take at the parties, whether they throw them themselves, as so often happens, and these witches, the so-called witch societies. Against this evil, we need not so much the enforcement of more laws, but the cleansing and the enlightened teaching of a revitalized religion that has the power to cast out demons by the positive example of love and faith. It is always easy to condemn offenders against the traditional moral code, and persons guilty of breaking the laws of the state. Of course, literally thousands, perhaps millions of young adults from high school age through their 30s and older are technically guilty of violating the various federal, state, other kinds of drug laws. In fact, from my investigations, I wonder who's keeping them. Now, very serious. That doesn't seem like anybody abides by them, including the policemen themselves. I've been in a lot of places where the chief source of supply are the policemen who take this stuff away from people and then resell it themselves at a profit. Very widespread. You can always get it from the man in blue, or something like this. But of course, some of you are old enough to remember Prohibition. I believe they had something on similar orders. We live in the new Prohibition era, so I don't think that laws are answers. Some estimates, which I consider conservative, say there are 10 million marijuana smokers in America. There probably are 10 million smoking outdoors and not even in public. You can walk through Cambridge Square and see people going 8 abreast, passing the joint back and forth, almost any campus, you know, this sort of thing. So really, it's ridiculous. There must be many thousands who use much harder substances and a futile attempt to find a better reality. And I always distinguish in my writings, I have sense of mentality between marijuana and drugs because there's no connection, except the connection of forcing people to go to the underground to find them. So oftentimes, and of course, so much of that is controlled by organized crime, and these pushers have absolutely nothing going but the desire to get as much money as possible from people, and they will try to push people into the harsher drugs on which they can be hooked and from which they can make more money. I do not commend these people, but I also do not condemn them. And again, this is a conclusion. You have to read the book to see what I'm saying. Since the alienation of character that possesses these people also possesses the rest of us. In North American society, and I dare say in civilized societies throughout the world, but probably in Japan, and in Western Europe, certainly, and Eastern Europe, it is not that dissimilar. This kind of alienation from self and community seems to be the condition of man in our century. And it is the question of degree as to how much of it we might have as an individual. Though on the other side of the law, those on the other side of the law are different only in degree from the remainder of us, not in kind. And the alienation and the frustration that now possesses us is not the creation of any one of us, but the very atmosphere of our society. What I'm saying, I suppose, is that the church should be the kind of agency that could meet the needs of people. It is not. At least not for the majority of the young. It is not for the majority of the educated. It is not for the majority of the sensitive, that is the morally sensitive as well as the culturally sensitive in our population. The many examples of human failure we see all around us are but reflections of a larger cultural and institutional failure that must be reversed and corrected before we can help individual cases. I would think that if we had an island on which was a mass epidemic of a communicable disease, it would be fruitless to cure individuals since they could not but be reinfected almost immediately. And I think, and this is of course going far afield and trying to be a prophet, which I'm not, that is the condition that we are in our society. The idea of winning one by one is doomed to failure. But Reinhold Niebuhr said it better than I ever can when he wrote that there are no moral men in an immoral society.
Say it again.
There are no moral men in an immoral society.
I don't think he said that.
I think that's what he means.
That,
moral man and
that's how it was put in 1933.
Yeah.
Moral man, immoral society.
Moral man in immoral society. Yeah. But there can't be a moral man in an immoral society, because the society also includes that man. It's like trying to make the distinction between good and bad German.
Or you might make that distinction.
Let's go into that.
Well, it's not to make that distinction.
Let's go into that later. Let's go into that in a minute. I think that takes... But the point I'm trying to make is the rescue effort of church and state on individual cases are just doomed to failure in this kind of general alienated society. We might fall out of one thing into another. There are signs that the church, at least in some of its institutional expressions, is more open to change and revitalization than is the state. Movements in the various denominations towards new codes of sexual morality, expressions of concern over the need to terminate the Indochina War, and the use of the church's influence, as much as we have left, to press for more scientifically based drug laws are all good signs. But as yet, they are only signs. And unfortunately, the liberalizing tendencies are usually at the top of churches, while the most conservative and punitive ideas remain strong on the local level, continuing to alienate the sensitive, the young, and the old. Only when compassion for one another, the sense that sharing and giving are more important than having and consuming, the ideas that underlie not only Christianity, but Judaism and Buddhism, are made real by our living them, will the searching minds among us find a releasing power greater than drugs than the and the lure of their cult. The age of Aquarius, in its conception as a wholesome ideal, is the age of peace, we're told. But without the demonstration of God's people, of the peace and love men long for, the religion of Aquarius may become one of disappointment, of frustration, of violence, and self-hate. If we are to cast out the demons of anxiety, fear, and self-doubt, the devils of undisciplined sensuality and self-abuse, the specters of a world continually involved in competition and warfare, it can only be by the expulsive power of a new affection for the God of love. In the offering of this new affection, we had best not offer a peace that passes understanding, but gain an understanding of what makes for peace. And instead of a vague and a rhetorical love of an invisible God, the church would be better to show a love for the man whom we can see and who desperately needs it. It's a way of summing up. Occultism has traditionally, by its own witness in the histories written by the occultic people, shown that it was based on alienation. There are two forms of occultic practice, and then I want to get to your question, because I think it's a very fundamental one, not only in this, but in a thousand other cases. Two forms of occultism, you're familiar with them if you read any paperback at all. White magic, black magic, okay? White magic, Sybil Leek and people of this nature say they're white magicians. This means that they want to perform rituals or ceremonies for good. And I dare say when we look at the history of ancient religion and the so-called primitive religion, some of you have heard me lecture before and know that I believe with Levi Strauss and with Mircea Eliade and others that the primitive religions are much more sophisticated than ours, which has been ruined almost by rationalism. the so-called primitive religions, life of cultism, are basically white or good in that they pray for harvest and for the fruitfulness of the flock, and they pray for health, and they pray for release from the demons, etc., etc., etc. This is supposed to be white magic. But along with it, in every case, there goes the black side. And this is in very philosophical equilibrium with even Aristotle's definition of justice, or the Old Testament's conception of justice. It is to do good to your friends and to do harm to your enemies. Black magic involves the laying of curses and spells. The cursing, which is even in the Old Testament. You know, we have the several incidents there where the magicians are employed to lay curses on the children of Israel. And we remember one of them could not supposedly lay this curse, he could only bless. But along with every form of occultism, always goes the conception that not only can one in some way manipulate the invisible forces for good, but one can also manipulate them for evil. How often, I wonder, have we not used Christianity in a cultic way? We pray for victory over our enemies. I suppose Abraham Lincoln is the best theologian in the 19th century when he said both sides pray to the same God, and both ask him for victory, and he can answer neither of them, and so neither one will be answered fully. Black and white. Basically, even beyond that, while we might say to wish the welfare of the community and of other people can't be completely condemned, there's something theological that we have to say about occultism too. And that is a very old term for Lutherans, work righteousness, if you will, synergism, that is taking of religion as a human work, and occultism is in a very pure form. The idea is that one does not do what the invisible powers, what God or the gods would have one do, but one, as it were, coerces or coaxes or lures or bribes the invisible forces into doing what they will. Not thy will, but my will be done, is the basic religious outlook of occultism, whether it be white or black. How many times do we not use Christian prayer in the same way? And I ask you very seriously, not thy will, but my will be done. And this runs through the whole history of human religion. We will slay a cock to Aesculapius. You know, we will lay open the entrails of a ram. We will read the stars. We will offer a sweet-smelling burnt offering. We will burn to Moloch, you know, the bodies of many children. We will offer and see the great black stone in Mexico. We will offer the heart of 1,000 maidens and young men, so that the sun will always move through his appointed course. Not thy will, my will be done. The basis of occultism is the conception of being able to manipulate, if it's not called the divine, sometimes it isn't, sometimes it isn't, to be able to manipulate the forces that are greater than man. I suppose this is why in the canonical codes in the Old Testament and the apodictic law, there was the phrase, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. Went directly contrary to the sovereignty of God. This was the idea. It's still there. Now I want to say something psychological about that and shut up. There's a reason why faith is so central theologically, and it makes good sense humanly speaking. There's a reason. Because faith does not mean the believing in many propositions, not even all the propositions in the Book of Concord, or something as simple as the Apostles' Creed. It doesn't mean believing anything, perhaps it can be put in words necessarily, but faith is trust. And trust is possible only in a centered personality that has itself together, that is at home, as it were, in family, in community, in universe. It trusts. It has nothing beyond the normal fears of falling or the normal cautiousness about danger. It is open. It can be friendly. Consequently, love can exist where faith is. It cannot exist where faith is not, because one must be open and trusting to be able to love. But to seek to manipulate is a sign not of a strong ego, of a strong center. It is not the sign of a strong man or woman that they exercise power over their spouse or their children or their workers or their congregation or anyone else. It is a mark of a very inferior feeling, very deflated and weak ego, that has to continually prove to itself that it has reality and stability by forcing on others manipulation. There you see, you dirty nigger, you know, I'm better than you. I really am a man or a woman or a prince or what have you. And so occultism, which I hope you might have gotten some little indication, can be practiced in the Lutheran liturgy and under good theology as well as in some demonic settings. Occultism is a mark of an alienated personality which cannot trust, it cannot be friendly, and it cannot love. And these forms of alienation, this sickness, which is a sickness unto death, will have constantly to be fed by the manipulation of God, by the manipulation of man, by chemical release, because we know we can change neural patterns, chemical flows now by various substances, by violence, by everything that is rightly called the demonic. The many forms of the demonic and the occultic is one that is very large and is surface in our day. And now you attack me and ask questions. I can't answer them, but I talk to you. Yeah.
I think this is
that's a theological and scriptural question. I ought to defer to a Bible scholar, but I would say that it certainly doesn't mean the manipulation of God. It would mean a relationship of trust to Christ and believing, trusting that it would come to pass. But it doesn't mean that, you know, you can tickle God and he will laugh for you. It's not manipulative, it's a faith relationship. Somebody can correct that if they like.
I'd like to ask a question. I can't think out of it. Maybe it's are these people under self-hypnosis and rusting, or do you really feel that they call upon the actual
I don't feel the latter, but I don't know either. Most of your occultic practices, like, let's be perfectly frank, you know, even if the people sitting in the chairs around here don't know, the young people around here probably do. Most smoking of pot and other things is self-suggestion anyhow. there's not enough THC in a carload, you know, to get off a midget most of the time. But you hyperventilate and you think that you're getting high, you know, and all that. I hate to tell you this, friend, but we even ran experiments on that at the VA hospital in Lexington, Kentucky for 3 years and proved that. We also proved it with alcohol, too, below a certain amount. So-called drunkenness on alcohol tends to be sort of self-stimulation, excuse to do things that you couldn't get away with doing, you know, if people thought you were sober. But I'll tell you about that privately sometime. A lot of occultism is just simply self-suggestion, you know. You want to believe it, and, you know, you get going with the thing, you know. We do it around here singing songs, you know, in a good way, so sometimes in a bad way, too. I think most of it's that. Of course, the psychotic episodes that people throw when they've been dealing with psychedelics or dealing with something very heavy, Steve, gag, no, heroin, you know, is the growing drug today. It is the drug of choice of your kids right down to junior high school. That hardly shouldn't be news to you because it's been true for some months. Those kinds of things are very real psychotic episodes that they're having. Now, whether they see the devil or not, I don't know. Personally, I don't think so.
I was wondering if your book went into any of
the stuff
that you
kind of know what? Goes into astrology, you know. No, not too much. That was something I had to make a decision on. Two things that interest me, you know, are very much part of this, and I'll simply say now, I had to eliminate the cause of length of time. One thing it would take about 5 years to get the research in, and we wanted to hit the market, you know, when we did, and we hit a book club, and that was important. And that may sound very crass to you, but there are people here that know if people don't read your book, it's not worth writing. You know? I had to rule out getting into the psychic phenomena area because that really has a long history. There's a lot of scholarly work. You know, Dr. Ryan, North Carolina, a lot of things in London. There's societies, so some 85 years old, have been keeping records on this. And the second was Edgar Cayce and healing. I guess Edgar Cayce is known to some of the people here. He's very, very big over in the Middle West and the Upper South, particularly in long Virginia, Maryland, I imagine a lot of places. I wanted to deal with that. I had a lot of students and their parents, for example, would come to me and talk about Edgar Cayce all the time. I was forced to read Edgar Cayce so I could talk happily intelligently with them. But if I had gotten over in that again, 2-3 years, I had to even decline the invitation to go to Virginia Beach to the Cayce Institute and be their guest to study. And Edgar Cayce's son was going to write the introduction to this book, something which was a priceless to me because of time. Maybe someday, because I think that's an interesting thing. Cayce was probably the most famous faith healer, if you want to put it that way, or something that has ever lived, I suppose. Thousands of cases on which they have a computerized index of what he said and what was done and so forth and how it was checked out with other physicians. Again, I don't have any judgments to make on it because I didn't get into the study. Yes, ma'am. Let's see if I hand some of those. Yeah. Of course, that's been going on since the 1700s, and it's been increasing in intensity because urbanization, rather than plateauing, is continuing to grow, and particularly in North America. And it will go that way, according to all expectations. The day comes when 95% of our people will live in standard metropolitan areas, you know, or more. And you can see the evidence of this as you go through the countryside already. Certainly that has something to say. Let me say one word about that too. This happened very early in Great Britain, one of the first industrialized countries. And there are similar kinds of experiences recorded from that time. And you remember that it was the time when drugs and things of that nature were not necessarily a part of Western experience, but alcohol was. When Wesley, for example, came upon the scene after his adventures and misadventures and so forth, I believe there was something on the order of above 70 gallons of gin per year being consumed in England for every man, woman, and child. That was the exact figure. Again, it was the way in which the wages were paid to the workers, and it was the food on which they lived. And, you know, that was the nourishment they got because of the exploitation of them by the landed gentry on the one hand and by the new industrial bourgeoisie on the other. And they're being pushed into the cities by the Land Enclosure Act, and some of you know British history better than I do, was directly responsible for this. And, you know, this is the reason why England has thousands of churches that don't have anybody going to them. They didn't go to them then because, of course, the people who had charge of these churches supported themselves, you know, off the misery of the poor, off the landed gentry, and the new industry and so forth. And to this, Wesley came. And, of course, Wesley combated what he considered witchcraft and what he considered occultism, because the only religion that the people had was essentially superstition. So that we have times, you know, we have very similar kinds of times, and I offer the example of John Wesley in the Methodistic Revival as a positive note, you know, that something can be done. The situation is not near as bad, I would judge, from reading history books now as it was then, from the standpoint of degeneration.
Yeah. John, do you think that people are able to communicate with the devil?
No.
Okay, why not?
I suppose because I'm still rationalistic to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Why not with the devil?
I find it hard to take the devil as seriously as I do God, very seriously. I suppose basically philosophical training, but also theologically as well. The devil has no real power in the basic philosophy of the West, as he doesn't have in the basic Christian philosophy of the West. The devil's power is that of illusion. It's a negative sort of thing. It's an emptiness. St. Augustine, I suppose, put it as well as anyone. The puffs and the power and the circumstance of the evil of the world are as naught, and disappeared. And I think Scripture would support that, although, you know, I'm not prepared tonight to give a full defense of that. He is the father of lies, the deceiver and the deceived. Certainly, the reality of sin is an objective phenomenon to me, because one of man's chief characteristics seems to be his ability to deceive himself or herself, and his overwhelming attraction for the illusory and the false. You know, the prophet said it again and again, how often, you know, you spurn the truth, how often you turn away the good, and you embrace the illusory, the empty, the false, that which has no substance, and give it honor. The famous charge against polytheism, a man takes a tree, it's a good tree, and he cuts it down, and he hews out lumber to build a house, and he builds furniture, and from some of the branches he builds ornaments. He takes the refuse from the tree, and he builds a fire, and warms his house, and bakes his bread. And from a little knot in the tree, which is of no use to anyone, he carves an idol and puts it on the mantle, and he bows down and says, "My Lord and my God." It seems to me that's as good a description of mankind as there is any place. The reality of the devil to me, and no one needs to accept this, of course, lies in just that facility in man, that essence of sin, you know, to believe and lie, the father's lie, sort of thing. So the evil is within us. the way I look at it.
Yeah. Are you saying you don't believe in taking a video?
No, no, I do not. And I rather, I know you would, but I rather doubt the monotheism of people who do believe in external devils, by the way.
I think you're not the only one in the room.
No, that's right, no, probably most people.
Can I throw out a situation that you have your friend?
Yeah.
When I was at Stanford, university, But he told them that 6 months prior, he had been told by Satan, he said he had a dream of Satan, that we were coming and he was not to even get near. Which is interesting because we didn't even receive the tip for 2 months prior.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew 3 months before we planned it that we were going to do it.
So logically, the devil was the author of your trip.
No, that was the thing because if you believe that Satan has access to some truth, but not all truth, then God could be the originator of the trip, and Satan might have known that.
That's the prelude to Job, you know, sends you down to tempt, huh? Now you get into all kinds of contradictions. This is one of the unresolved problems in theology we have to deal with. I'd rather have a vague feeling as a theologian attached to the fact that we've never completely worked out in the West our doctrine of God. As you know, the article on the Holy Spirit is incomplete in the Creed. And many, many theologians over centuries, including starting with Luther, for example, declared that we need to work on that. This business about the devil, one of the teachers of the furthest out, most alienated people that I know, whether they think of themselves as occultic people or as Christians, are those who take the devil so seriously as a person. I don't mean by that to laugh and snap and say there's no evil. No, that's truly true. How can you walk across the room and do that? But to objectify and personify the devil. There's another insight, too, that comes to us from literature. I suppose Arthur Miller made it very clear for many people in his play, The Crucible. Has anyone ever seen The Crucible? You know what we're talking about. You know the period of time in which The Crucible is set, the so-called Puritan period, the period when the church was established by law in Massachusetts Bay Colony and some several other colonies of what is now the United States, was a period not when men were very hotly gospel-oriented and evangelistic. You need to get down and read the works of Cotton Mather and those divines and look at them, but they were deistic. They did not take the incarnation and the gospel seriously. They had a rationalistic religion and a superioristic morality which enabled them, you know, to fall on their knees and then on the aborigines, as the punter is put it. And, you know, and to the aborigines' dismay, and they had no living gospel. And God to them was far away, as he was to George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and a lot of others who were very honest. You know, God has made the world like the good German Swiss clockmaker that he is, and it will run without fail, and he has retired away into heaven. As one of the prophets says, has your God gone to the bathroom? I believe he's like it. I'm not 150 years off because it's the same kind of season.
16 parties there in Salem and all that, and the 18th century, and
no, I'm calling it deism, which is a good German English term for later, but it's the idea of a God that leads man to manipulate the world the way man wants to manipulate, because God won't interfere. New continent, built the new institution, push people in the pattern, they don't fit, drive them out to Rhode Island. That I'm trying to get at, they didn't take God very seriously. Now, second hypothesis. Man can't live like that, which is part of what's wrong with us in religion today. We can't live with a remote God, or with no God, or with myths that are dry and dull and settled. Man needs living personification, what the religious philosopher calls myth, experience, if you will. So what becomes increasingly clear, and we could go through history and give you some other examples if you don't want to accept that one, is that when man cannot believe in God, he can very certainly believe in the devil. He can believe in the devil. And usually does. I wouldn't have at the end of this book, but that was some time ago. But now, I think you know I'm doing research because I've been provoked into it by a number of different sources on it, and it seems to still be growing. I would predict that it's going to buck the tide that religion is on the decline in North America now, and occultism is going to grow. Yes, it is growing. For one reason, it never really took the kind of public eye in any time in the past. At any time. But let's just briefly look at occultism since our eyes of Christianity. This is just a brief touch over. And unless you want to buy the argument of the occultists themselves that what we are doing is practicing the old religion, you know, the religion of Woden and Thor, the religion of the Druids and the old Britons and so forth, and you get many history books that will tell you this. I think it's kind of nonsense myself. There's never any evidence given for this. But unless you want to buy that and that the ancient paganism of our Nordic and Anglican ancestors has always existed, occultism has flourished only when it's been consciously revived, and usually by intellectuals. It's not a, you know, a strange thing. Dr. Faustus, university professor, sets in the context of Renaissance learning. It has usually been revived out of a romantic, adventurous alienation in an intellectual setting. The Renaissance is the closest parallelism to the kind of widespread popularity of occultism that we have today. The very people who were discovering these laws of physics that existed for so long, who were discovering new continents, who were discovering new ways of looking at the world, who were finally accepting the fact that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe, who were finding out the circulation of the blood, all these kinds of things. The ancient languages were being re-deciphered so that they could recover the heritage of Greece and Rome. These same people were practicing occultists in many cases. The great astronomers cast horoscopes in order to make their living. Many of the texts which they sought to recover were magical texts. Many times they let the texts of philosophers and theologians go and took the text of the alchemists, for example, the whole history of alchemy, which is a mixture of science and of occultism, something I don't think is completely gone from science in this century either. That's another story. But the Renaissance was not only recovery of the ancient learning and opening of new horizons in the beginning of modern times, and out of which too comes the Reformation period in the church, but it was also a time of widespread occultic practices and beliefs. Lutherans and Calvinists, Catholics, Anabaptists all burned witches at the stake. There was upsurge of this at the very time of Reformation. And it certainly wasn't because the unsplit Catholic Church hadn't done its best in the art of the faith in the Inquisition to try to put this kind of thing down. Because again and again, the Inquisition in Spain, as you can believe the historical record, was not so much about doctrinal diversity or authority controversies, but it was over questions of occultism. Some of them due to the influx of the Moors and the proximity of Africa, but not all. So that there are periodic reoccurrences of occultism, and I would say this, although the word is badly chosen, I don't know a better English word, artificially reconceived is what I would say.
What is demonic?
Demonic means that which breaks humanity, that which breaks community, that which destroys. The very real power.
Well, John, a connection it came to my mind as you were telling about the Renaissance. I wasn't aware of that. I was certainly not so sorry.
I'm not either, because I read a little bit.
And what you said earlier, too, about something you might believe in the devil as a, as a real power. Without going through that again, but it's certain that in the time of the Renaissance, as little as I know about it, is a time when old ideas were being thrown out or were being shoved aside by a great surge of, you know, new ideas and things, all in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it also occurred to me that, as I understand it, this could be a book.
I'm remembering it all. It
has to go short, but that the Pharisees in the time of Jesus sort of epitomized God as the property of good people and of the established order that was acceptable, officially acceptable. So that, and if that's still applied, and Jesus warned, you know, beware of the Pharisees, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, one of his most oft-repeated powerful statements, you know, to his followers, I think it still applies. It may have applied during the Renaissance times, too, coming in and out of the hearing, if you will. But if God is the property of the good established people, and the new ideas come flowing in which upset the good established people, then God sort of gets shoved out of the way, and what are we going to do with all this power that we're suddenly experiencing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
These new ideas that are putting things together for us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You say, man, there's something here. You know, there's something here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people of God say that it's ungodly. Huh? They say it's ungodly. They say it's demonic. So, we'll go through the demonic then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that things get tagged that way, and I think there's a real, you know, I think that could be a tie-in as to why maybe these two things, perhaps, you know, fall into the statement on the Renaissance. These two things might tend to come together.
Let me not argue with you and say immediately, among other things, that I'm not a historian, but the Pharisees were the liberals of Jesus' time.
I know.
They were not the conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And although it's easy to characterize them as saying God is the property of the good people, that isn't necessarily the case. The problem with them was the split between profession and practice. I believe what Jesus said was, what they teach you to do, do, but do not act as they act, because they do sit in Moses' seat. And he implied that if a man knew Moses and the prophets, you know, he had no need of a man even returning from the dead to know the truth in one of his parables. So that I think that kind of argument falls to the ground.
But he went beyond that.
Of course he did.
He went beyond that, and
yes,
he said you must show yourself to be more righteous.
Yes, but of course with a different conception of righteousness as from God rather than from law. But now let's pass the Renaissance. In that part of the world, where the church did not reform itself without in the least wanting to engage in anti-Catholic polemic. But in that part of the world, in Italy and in Spain and in the South, where the church did not reform itself and hasn't done so until our present century, when miracles are happening in the Catholic Church, where, this is where Renaissance was very openly received. I mean, the Pope subsidized the scholars. This is where the new learning really arose. It arose in Italy, you know, where the artifacts and the manuscripts were, and it arose in the East. Now, at places, the Pharisees who ruled the Catholic Church said, foul, no, you can't do that. Galileo, you know, get down on your knees and we can't, you know, and all of that sort of thing. But they didn't stop the study, and the studies did go on. It was only when they found them threatening in some theological way that they stopped it. Now, that doesn't mean that Renaissance didn't happen in Germany and in Holland and the North, too, but it happened in a different way. And again, the Protestants were much heavier taskmasters against the new scholars than were the Catholics, I think, if you look at
history. Well, see, now, I can see that the implication was in what I said, which I didn't intend to convey. Namely, the reference to the establishment of the good people as implying the top crust.
Yeah.
Which is not what I mean.
Okay.
That's not what I mean. I mean the whole gamut of respectable people, from
mm-hmm.
respectable vendors to respectable people.
Yeah.
From respectable farmers, merchants, or whatever the people were doing in those days. And I took the top crust.
Well,
but the people always,
I don't mean to look at the social judgment of their day and say that's something, but I mean, if you look back at the way things were functioned, let's just deal with new ideas and old ideas and do that. Renaissance was mixed with both things, you see. Renaissance, as we traditionally understand it, came about by the fact that certain scholars, who were clergymen, by the way, the Catholic Church, trained themselves in the ancient language as much as they could, so they could begin to recover that which had been known and had been lost for the most part. The people had never been lost completely, obviously. There was never such thing as doctors or completely. But for the majority of people, literacy had declined. These things were not known. So it was a rediscovery of these kind of ideas that gave them a new belief in man. This is not the thing of time. And man's possibility, if you have understanding the mess and the world, it's in a religious context, that you take it as a technical. And whether it helps or not, they were going to do it. And so first there was recovery of old values, and it's just ideas are ideas. It doesn't matter who said them or when. An idea of Confucius can move us, you know, towards some new insight at this moment, as much as, you know, a new idea from a brand new college graduate. And so new ideas just come. They were frightened, but they were also exhilarated. And very probably, because I don't want to argue with you, and this is totally saying, yeah, I really think it's true, after doing a lifetime of reading and walking around the world and studying people, probably most people just didn't know. They were just confused. The ones who had to deal with the material, some were upset, some were exhilarated, probably most were both. And most people didn't know.
Would you put forth a counter hypothesis for this invention then of the occultism at this time?
I can only say this, that it was incipient in the ancient material. And this is very clearly seen in all the studies on alchemy. You see, a science which has given us both the idea of, you know, making spells to cause all sorts of things that we would say magical, you know, no rational reason. For example, the famous belief which we're told alchemists didn't really believe, that you can transmute lead and gold. This would be great because you'd get lots of lead, but gold was hard to come by. That was incipient in the same material that also showed men how to recover salt, how to recover brass, of mace, brass, and lead, you know, all sorts of things. Out of that, you know, it's a mixed blessing, if you will, comes a movement towards some magic, as well as a movement towards medicine and towards chemistry. I dare say again, you know, not trying to play the old friendly philosopher, but it's really true. Most things are mixed blessings.
When they went back and started looking at it again, the whole thing just came up. That once again, it could have been looked at, and it got impressed was.
Of course they did, and this is what Marlowe meant, what Guerra meant, and the Dr. Faustus meant. About devil?
Yeah.
I think he meant exactly what he said, but he's using scriptural language. He's speaking an unbroken myth, you know, just speak, in a post-built monument way.
I think I have to hear more of this.
Yeah. Right.
I'll try to
about Luther now, about what?
Yeah,
Luther knew the devil well by his own account, you know, from his mother's breast. He said that...
What was Jesus talking about?
Oh, I don't even doubt that Jesus said it, you know? It's in the text. Okay. This off the top of the head shouldn't even be on tape. Okay. The idea of Satan, the tempter, comes into the Jewish faith at the time of the exile, historically speaking. At the time when a large segment, not numerically, but in quality, of the educated, the military leaders, the political leaders, the royalty, and so forth, were carried away as hostages into the Middle Eastern countries, where the religions there were dualistic, and where many of them still are, the remnants of Zoroastrianism and Sarsayism, so forth. Best seen in 8th century prophets, Zoroaster, that divided the universe into the realm of two gods, Ahura Mazda, the god of light, and Ahriman, the god of darkness. And he saw all life as the yin and the yang, which is both the Chinese term, but it's the struggle of light and darkness, of good and evil. It's symbolized for us by the Taoist symbol, you know. If you've ever seen a South Korean flag, you've seen it. This was the basic religious dualism of the Middle East. It is a dualism which is endemic and animistic religion, but the dualism is endemic in most human religions. And Jewish people were exposed to it. And we know that generations later, the descendants of that group were returned once again to the Canaanite soil, and they returned again to rebuild the land and to reestablish the faith. They were not unmarked by their sojourn of so many generations in the midst of this dualistic faith. And may we say right here that Zoroastrianism is one of the high moral religions of all mankind's history. And it said, enlist yourself in the service of the God of light against the God of evil, because the struggle is intention and the cosmic potential, and it is unsure. And the imagery then that comes in Old Testament, and in particularly in the intertestamental literature we call Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, that has the struggle. When we get down to Dead Sea Scrolls, we even find one scroll that is called the War of the Sons of Light against the Sons of Darkness. The, if you will, the infection of the dualism of the Middle Eastern faith is very strong. And so it permeates the language of the late Old Testament period, what we call the intertestamental period, and certainly into the time of Jesus. it permeates the time's expectation. When if we can accept the, how the Bible scholars reconstruct this, and again, Bible scholars present can, you know, correct this, not controvert me, correct me, it is endemic and the apocalyptic way of looking at things. That is, that there is a struggle so profound between these opposing forces that the battle which will, in other words, resolve the Cold War is imminent. Armageddon, as it's called in Revelation. This is in the air. This is part of the whole expectation. And part of the coming of this will be God's Messiah. And the expectation for the Messiah, of course, dates for the most part after the angelic period and in the intertestamental period. And it's a Messiah, by the way, and a kind of Messiah that Jesus himself refused to accept, but that's neither here nor there. And so the language of the Christ and the thought forms of the Christ, and these are short course and interpretation in the New Testament, is permeated with this. It had to be. You can no more communicate with them than I can communicate with you if I was not familiar with some of the political facts and literary facts of our century and our time. And not only that, you know, when I talk about Adam, when I talk about schizophrenia, when I talk about paranoia, I'm using mythological language too, and I hope the doctors know that. At least the psychiatrists, at least some of them realize this. We're talking about, and this myth framework, yes, he spoke that way. And the word devil, the word tempter, like the word kingdom or realm, refers to real things, the objective experiences. But now when you begin to get down to objective personification, you're passing out of the realm of religious myth. You're passing into the occult. And it happened. The occultic strain that grew out of Judaism over many hundreds of years later, as my historical mind is trying to remark me, is called Kabbalah. But it has its roots, even there. And it is in the Bible as well, the numerology and the gemnology. The book of Revelation is a full of occultic language, although it is not used in occultic ways. The idea of the rubies and the diamonds and the agates and the stones and the seven this and the five that, you know, and the four this and the three that is all the language of occultism. And the idea of the great battle of Armageddon is the war of sun, of light and darkness. All of this reflects a dualistic emphasis. This is much easier to see to a philosophically trained mind that realizes that there are basically only two philosophies in life. That is, two ways of looking at the world. As a unity, or as more than a unity. That is, as a duality or more. We say monism, dualism. Late Judaism, as it responded to the prophets beginning in 8th century and later, Isaiah and after, moved theologically towards monotheism. It was never fully complete, but towards monotheism, which demands monism. If there's one God, you know, there's only one world, one way of looking at the world. But the dualistic element and the religious element, the religious influence that came not just from Middle East, but from Near East and from the ancient past, are all there in Scripture. And that language is a confusing thing there. And one has to, as it were, kind of look at it objectively. This monistic is this dualistic, to try to make the separation out. Now, the problem is extremely acute when you believe in one God, when you have monistic worldview. Because then you come to the crunching question from which Luther didn't shrink, but whom only Calvin was foolish enough, I suppose, to push its ultimacy, and everyone ought to study Institutes of Christian Religion. Because then you have to face up to what we call the problem of evil. which many people talk about, very few people understand. And it's, I'm not sure that I understand either. But in the simplest form is this. If there's one God, and if he is Allah-Master, he's all-powerful, he's all-good, why is it easy? And the answer is so easy to talk about temptation and tempter and Satan. And to avoid the answer of the prophetic portion of the Pentateuch. Because you see, the early books of Genesis are not from the pre-exilic period. They're from the post-exilic period, the J-E-D-T literature. The Genesis accounts about man's creation and so forth are prophetic. They're written later. All evidences in the world point to this. It lays the answer at the door of a God who was so good, he made man in his own image with perfect freedom, and freedom in brief includes the license to go wrong. It is not in our stars, but in ourselves that we are evil. As the answer of the Old Testament, I would think of the New as well, to the occultic idea and to the demonic in general. And this in no means denies the demonic and what is represented by the devil. But with this you can do something.
How do you interpret Jesus
driving out the demons? The act of healing. I think it can happen even today,
okay.
By the way. You might refer to it as that. It's mentally ill, it's socially ill. I remember that some of the people he healed, you know, had diseases of a moral order, who were not necessarily of a neurological order. But certainly I don't believe, and I don't suspect you do, that he drove out little creatures that had some shape and form that could enter into bodies of pigs and straightway fell over a hillside and drowned. You know, very funny this story, which is included in one of the Gospels.
But he always refers to healing and
testing. Out demons, yes. But does he say two separate things? If I talk about teaching and preaching, it sounds like two separate things. In my mind, they're not two separate things. Or affirming and loving, they're not two separate things. Casting out demons are very real things. And those particularly, I would say, and here there's some missionaries that would be able better to speak to this. If you were in a context of culture where people believed in the reality of these demons and you did not, I would think you would be at a great loss trying to deal with them in a constructive way. If you don't take them too seriously, but you would have to take them seriously. You start where people are. Jesus didn't come into the world with the ideas of 20th century man. You know, it's foolish when theologians try to make out that he did. He came into the world as a man in that time and that place. And you know those ideas.
Dualism's
not that prominent in the New Testament, except in the apocalyptic portions like Revelation and in some parts of Mark. Two opposing forces. It's mostly in the Old Testament you find it, but all the apocalyptic literature is basically dualistic because it's bringing it up to
the
head.
I mean, it just seems to me like there's a basic convention going on that dualism, or that there is man and there are God, and there are those two beings.
Mm-hmm.
That either one believes in one God or man, and that's it. Or in two or more gods, fighting it out in man. And my understanding of the biblical scripture is that God is a God, but that the view of Satan is not that of a God, but as another spiritual being of a slightly inferior kind.
This is a very good question because I absolutely, you're right in the traditional interpretation, but you see, there isn't anything in scripture about that. There's a great deal in literature. But you don't find that in Scripture. Jude? So would you tell me Jude again? Yeah.
Jude 2, I think that's the echoes of the myth.
It's not really found in Scripture about the archangel Michael and then the archangel Satan and so forth. Yeah. Also, you know, you can find in 2 Peter a reference to karma and the wheel of birth and death, but I don't think we take it very seriously. It's an echo of a religious language. Otherwise, you know, we're going to believe in reincarnation and so forth. It's actually in there, you know, about release from the wheel of birth and death. You have to put that down as someone using the ideas that were available to him, you know, making a mistake, I would say, definitely, at that point, because that's an Hindu idea, and yet it's there in the Petrine Epistle. You know, one has to enter into this, and I would not like to use the word theism, which you use, because theism is philosophical rather than a theological word. Monotheism, okay? And don't mean to imply that most people, certainly consciously, are dualists, not in rational Anglo-Saxon society anyhow. But at this point, I would say it makes really a little difference about this kind of so-called limited dualism, which is the term that you're using. The great theological exponent of that was John Milton. It's rather interesting that in his literature, and I'm not knocking Milton as a writer, he's great, but the devil comes off as the hero of the universe. Not God. And Jesus Christ comes off as a weak, namby-pamby something or other. You should read it sometime. I give a little passage in here from this, and I'm convinced that the old blind man certainly believed in God, but it just got away from him. See if I can find that. Gee, if you can read Milton seriously the way some people tell me they read literature, and they get really turned on and moved and not come off worshiping the devil, then you have a very strong, non-suggestible mind. So I just have a little passage in here. There's a good deal about the devil in here, by the way, if you'd like to read it. You know, it's like, which way I fly is hell. Myself am hell. Others at last relent. Is there left no place for repentance? None for pardon left? None left but by submission, and that word disdain forbids me. And with hope, farewell fear, farewell remorse, all good to me is lost. Evil be thou my good. By thee at least divided empire with heaven's king I hold. By gosh, if you can't admire the person that could have said that, you know, you don't have much humanity. Satan comes off better than God in Milton. And the theology of American fundamentalism, where this devil business is the strongest, by the way, in the world, straight out of Milton. Straight out of Milton.
I really don't think the fundamentalists know or care that much about Milton.
Personally, as individuals, they may not, but, you know, they were taught by teachers like Strong and Hedge and other systematic theologians who certainly did care a great deal about Milton and knew him quite well, as they knew their Shakespeare. Well, you know, out of the ears, because it's part of culture and everything. And you have to make two distinctions. Let me answer a question I left unanswered earlier, and that was this business about Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan. To me and to most people who have been looking at it, that's just a joke for the most part. It's a way he's found to make money, you know, like the guy that sells the plastic bunnies in gas stations. It's not a way to make money. And he has a record of a circus performer, lion tamer, and he goes around and holds, you know, nude ceremonies and all sorts of grueling things and that sort of thing, and very carefully never does anything illegal, you know, and that sort of thing. But now some of the people that get attracted to these things, like the group in Louisville, might be a different story. And I don't think LeVay would be comfortable with them myself if he thought they were taking it seriously. But now, like the group that I was reading you the passage about was no church of Satan and no church of anything. It was a group of people who lived together and who more or less, you know, were together all the time. They worked at the jobs they had to work at, which one of the things I found out from a sociological point of view was in every case, many, many economic steps below what they could have qualified for, even with the education they got before they just dropped out of school. So they didn't care anymore about going on. It was just enough, you know, like pumping gas. Most of them were like white-collar clerical jobs, filing and things like that, to keep going, to have the money, to keep the lifestyle going. It was very common among young people today, by the way, in every respect. They could have done more if they wanted to do more without getting into the capitalistic hassle, but it was just to keep this thing going. Whereas I look at that Church of St. Satan as a shuck in the nose part, these kinds of Satanists I look at as being extremely dangerous. Because without playing Perry Mason or something, there's no large city in the Western world that you can go to. The police departments won't tell you about ritual murders, most of which are not reported as such, every year. And this has been true for a long time. I'm not saying it's done on altars with rituals or not, but nevertheless, there are ritualistic types playing, and it's the acting out of various kinds of psychoses. And sometimes down through, people do kill for thrill, and they do kill accidentally. One of the things that I've learned. Is, to the people that we can still reach, I think it would be, to put it in a cliche, an example of total involvement, you know, in the problems of society, and people's real problems.
Yeah.
No, it has to be done on larger groups. Larger groups.
What?
Pardon? That, I can't really know. Of course, you know, the Lutherans are going to have one. Well, they're having one now, I guess. We're having the Dallas thing. And you're talking about Explo that started about 2 weeks ago, though. That sort of thing is just mass media, mass meeting type thing, which on a lot of other grounds I would think is going to be fairly useless, because it does stress this one-to-one kind of thing. The only way one-to-oneness really works, I think, can be seen. Let me give you an example. Is in a group like Children of God. You know Children of God? And even then, it's not foolproof, or they wouldn't be involved in so many lawsuits. Well, this is why there were monasteries and nunneries all during the Middle Ages, and there still are some. And there are even some Protestant monasteries. In order to get someone. And there are Buddhist monasteries, by the way, in India. I just talked to a boy and girl at Defiance College the other day who are going to the Hindu monastery in Detroit. In order to get on a one-to-one basis and convert someone to a new philosophy or religion and change their lifestyle and keep them there, you have to take them out of the culture in which they are and insert them in a, you know, a pure culture, so to speak, like this. And that's not very likely, except maybe for an elite. And there's times in history where elites like that have come in handy. The Irish monks, for example, are responsible for Renaissance movement. But it doesn't do much, you know, for the great masses of suffering humanity either. The people who get turned on and reach that alpha wave state, you know, the ecstasy, and get converted to something, and then stay in the culture, they need constant reinforcement. They need primary and secondary reinforcement, you know, the whole psychological business. But that is not enough. given a mass electronic culture like ours to last for very long. And so most of your Jesus truth and your cultic truth, for that matter, will break down after a while. That doesn't mean it won't proliferate and make other groups, but they will break down and the people will be lost. One of the chief attributes of the extremely religious person of our time is his perambulation from group to group. And I'll just throw this in for your benefit. Most of the real hardcore Jesus people that I've investigated, at least east of the Mississippi, had some contact with the devil or devil worshippers or demonry, and as they thought of it as demonry in some kind. Almost invariably. Very large one. So that you, again, Eric Hoffer tells us about the true believer, you know. So I would expect that we'll be seeing Jesus people moving the other way, frankly. And maybe back again, and on. Because as long as we stay in the culture, which is permeated by this feeling of no solution and no fixation, we will move. Let me just throw one last really dastardly thing in and say the reason most of us are in a Lutheran church is the blood that flows in our veins rather than the belief that flows in our hearts. I think it's a sin, but it's true of me. You know, there are ties, and I suppose each one of us could point, you know, to a familial tie, a blood tie, and this sort of thing. So there's got to be things to hold you there so that you don't go wandering off, becoming a Methodist, and this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah. But it has to start, right?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. You're right.
I mean, I'm very sorry. The time changed when I was very grateful that I've been taking
the
study school since I was 3 years
old. Oh, right on, yeah.
Because I've
right on.
To go back to the
food,
you know, that may not be enough for it to start.
But now, don't you see, you were taking the Sunday school. I wasn't all that much, but some. I had a strong domineering set of German grandparents. That was something. But now we're dealing with the generation who grew up seeing the Looney Tunes at 10 and 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. This is the generation of them that played golf on Sunday. Their fathers, their mothers. Three generations then, you see, for the most part. And so we don't have those things to grasp onto. Now, I in no way, personally, or theologically, philosophically, psychologically, would deny, and certainly not sociologically, the reality of peak experiences, conversion experiences. But I also will say this, for everyone that builds up and is not sustained by primary and secondary reinforcement and by community, it arrives about as rapidly as it occurs. And the longer...
I'm curious as to why you're opposed to the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses, because they fulfill so many of the things you had just suggested for it.
Because it's not the truth.
For a group of people who have a strong conviction and have a sense of community with each other in the church, and in the case of Mormons in some of the cities.
You're right. But it's a question of the truth, I suppose. You know, Dean Kelly of the National Council of Churches has just written a book called Why the Conservative Churches Are Growing, and says exactly what you said, and gives graphs and charts to back it up. His big example to hold up the Lutherans, Presbyterian, Methodists, and Episcopalians that are losing members is the Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and a couple of other smaller sects. But he never faces up because he's writing as a sociologist of religion. He doesn't face up to a theological question. Is it the truth? I suppose that's it. But, you know, the Hitler Youth also gave the sense of community, and a Waffen SS. And the Red Guard gives a sense of community. And the Little Red Book of Mao probably is moving more people than anything else.
What I would say about the European experience is that after the experience, Germany was lucky to have a great man, Konrad Adenauer, and the Christian Democratic Party. And Konrad Adenauer, in his autobiography, that the two groups in Germany who were most immune to Nazism and to communism were Catholics and Protestants who were believers. Now those believers, I don't know much about the depths of their belief, but the point is they carried on a sense of Christianity, both Protestants and Catholics, that made Germany as good a place to live in as any part of the world after those horrible ordeals. Mm-hmm. And after France had been occupied by the Germans, it was de Gaulle who was a great man there and the people around him. And then when the Algerian War was so horrible, it was once more de Gaulle, a French Catholic. And the religious belief of Adenauer and de Gaulle is quite indispensable for for France and Germany being as good as they are. And incidentally, in Algeria, there's a historian who is an acquaintance of mine who made a study of the revulsion of the French soldiers to the Algerian War, and there was a strong correlation between their religious beliefs and their dislike of what they were doing there in terms of torture.
I had no doubt.
And so, it seems to me that some of the groups in America here, who are the fundamentalist start, are not really inferior to French and German Catholics who came to the support of Adenauer and de Gaulle.
Let's back up now. I would think, and again, I don't want to argue with you, but what you said simply reinforces. No, because I couldn't. But what you have said just reinforces what we're talking about, is, you know, real religious belief that results in some community feeling not only immunizes, but builds something good. But I suppose the depth of the degradation and alienation of the 20th century is that there were so few firm Protestant and Catholic believers in Deutschland and in France. The one thing I would take serious exception would be the reality of the religion of de Gaulle, and probably about now both, but certainly of de Gaulle. But there were so few believers that they could do nothing or did do nothing against such demonic forces in their time. And that, although I would certainly find it very psychologically believable that French soldiers of a devout nature would have found this electricity torture of the Algerians revolting, I know this from my own experience in war that it's true, but it was not enough, because there were not enough Christians and not enough communities to stop that thing from going on for 7 years. And what finally ended Hitler, you know, was the greatest combination of just brute might in the history of the world. And what finally ended Algeria was the simple expediency of a brilliant politician, de Gaulle, a great man, who saw that it was bleeding his country white. I would say the very same kind of reasoning that, if it ever happens, will end the Vietnam War for us. It won't be religion, it will be expediency. So that against this, I would say, what if there had been stronger Protestant and Catholic community in Germany? What if, you know, Catholicism hadn't been dead in France, you know, since 1780? You know, what if in America we were not just nominal, but strong? That's really all I'm saying. And I say, in the absence of the strength of integrity and character and community, one has to expect the demonic in the form of the occultic. Nazism, and I'm going to stop now because we're all tired, Nazism was full of the symbols of the occult. And the stories about Hitler and his astrology, I believe implicitly.
That is historically a lie. Bullock, in his book.
Alan Bullock
says that some of the men around Hitler believed in astrology, but Hitler did not. He himself considered himself a scientist and a materialist. Mm-hmm. And he had nothing to do with astrology. I'm not trying to defend Hitler, except to say that Hitler, as a matter of fact, said that if he won, he would eventually dismantle the churches. And what he would put up in place of the churches in each city square, incidentally, most of the cities designed like the city of Lent, mm-hmm. which was considered the ideal city of the world,
all the
would be the telescope. and the laboratory of the astronomer. He says that's the most perfect science, and it's the most rational sense of the universe is gained through the telescope. Therefore, in place of the cross, there would be the telescope, not the astrological chart.
But nevertheless, and this may be true because I realize there's a difference between the historians on this, the symbols of Nazism are occultic. The Huff and Freud, as you know, goes back to Nietzsche.
He had a exploitation of that, but he himself probably did not believe. He mentioned that the swastika itself he got that from the monastery 35 miles from Vienna when he was a young man.
I had read recently that he inherited when he joined the Nationalist Socialist of Arbeit Party. They already were using it for some reason or other. But in any event, it is a mystical symbol. And of course, you know, the mass torch-like parade and all the business about the blood in the soil and the German race is pure occultism, natural religion. Whether or not you believe it is immaterial. It's acting it out, I suppose. It probably had as much hold on the people as Christianity ever did. You know, not just because they were Germans or French, but because they were human beings.
Yeah.
And communism, of course, too, without getting into that, old ploy, is a substitute, a pseudo-religion among those who accept it and believe it. One last thing I quit. One of the fun things that we had when we were bombarded one time for some 35 days, constantly, without let up, without shelling, was that, oh, every 50th shell or so was a propaganda shell in Korea, and it was full of leaflets. And they'd get these beautiful rice paper leaflets with the proletariat breaking the chains and his heart pierced, you know, by the capitalistic sword, and the blood of the proletariat redeeming the people of the world. I mean, it was, all you had to do was write Jesus Christ under it, and you could have you had it, you know. And there are others that were even funnier than that. But to those who believe in that doctrine, Marxism is not only a materialistic philosophy, but it is a way of life. It's a religion. Again, it flourished on soil where Christianity did not live up to its promise. It's interesting. Okay. Catholic Spain and Franco, and it's too late. We can talk about it again if you want to talk more about occultism, because it's very much a part of our life, I think. Thank you.